Good evening. James McKenna here with My Science Hour, September 8th, 2016. Tonight's main science topic, world population, what does it mean? Going to be doing some interesting analysis here. First, a couple quick announcements. The study I announced last week, I would like to get some volunteers. Maybe up to 20 hours a week for, it won't take all that long, but you would need an internet, good internet connection, of course computing equipment, and a little bit of time to help out with this study. If you are available to do that, then email at the following address, info@jmccsci.com. I wanted to add to last week's show, I talked about the two hurricanes approaching Hawaii. And by the way, Hurricane Lester didn't even come close to Hawaii. It veered north, of course, not following the predicted route of the National Hurricane Prediction Center, and totally missed Hawaii also, although it maintained a little bit higher winds. But remember that the Madeline, the first storm of the pair, totally fizzled out. And you can see that in the data as it approaches the Big Island of Hawaii. It just comes apart at the seams. And so anyway, I wanted to add to that whole dialogue about the hurricanes last week that in 1995, I proposed to the U.S. military a solution to prevent hurricanes from making landfall on especially the eastern United States, the Gulf of Mexico, and of course down through the Caribbean, through the Gulf of Mexico, and then the Caribbean, of course, which is filled with islands that just get hammered when the hurricanes come through because they have no defense. And so what I had was a plan to duplicate what happens at Hawaii. Now, just to repeat, what happens when the hurricanes approach Hawaii, happens to be very deep water off the east side of Hawaii, and the hurricanes come from the east, moving westerly through the Pacific Ocean. All of a sudden, when they get about 100 miles away from the Big Island of Hawaii, the volcano Mauna Loa, which is about a 13,500-foot volcanic mountain, active, has an electrical connection to the ionosphere. And it's not always the strongest connection, but it's there. But what happens is the electrical current that's driving the hurricanes across the Pacific Ocean, those combine. And the way they combine is it's a basic principle of physics. When two electrical currents with currents moving in the same direction come close enough together, they pull themselves together. It's called the pinch effect. And so what happens is because the mountain is stable there of Hawaii, it literally pulls the current sheet off that's driving the hurricane, and the hurricane comes apart. Simple as that. So what I did is I proposed a similar method, and here's how it would work. Say there's a hurricane bearing down on Florida or one of the Caribbean islands. You would come along literally with aircraft like C-130s or military aircraft and drop buoys. And the buoys would go into the water, float, and then have a chain that drops down, a metal chain that drops down and anchors at the seafloor, which is grounding it out. And then coming off the top of the buoy would be a very fine metal fiber cord, and this would be attached to weather balloons that would then be up in the atmosphere. So what you've got is an electrical current path from up in the atmosphere, probably a few thousand feet up, down to the floor of the ocean. And so you drop these all along the front where the expected hurricane would come, and as the hurricane leading edge came along that, it would start to short out to the bottom of the seafloor. And this would be a way of sucking the energy out of hurricanes and causing the hurricane to dump its water offshore. The military never responded. Anyway, there are some other stories involved in that back in that same era. when I was working with the Russian scientists at the University of Novosibirsk, I proposed a method for controlling hurricanes using laser satellites. And those techniques were later developed. The actual satellites, the U.S. military developed those techniques, put up laser satellites in the early 2000s, and used them. These are the hurricane manipulation satellites, laser satellites, that they're using to create Katrina and other disastrous hurricanes. And you can see them doing this. You can see the eye as they put the laser beam down in the eye and literally pull the hurricane around like a bull with the ring in a nose and direct those hurricanes and increase their energy. And the whole purpose of that was to lead the hurricanes away from population centers. It just tells you how deranged and distorted science is today. The Russians, the team of Russian scientists, went to the United Nations and told them that the United States has weapons of weather mass destruction, basically, of weather manipulation, and that they should be classified as internationally outlawed weapons. The United States, being on the Security Council, would not sign off on that. So anyway, a little bit of history about hurricanes. Here's a story I wanted to discuss, just a little anecdote about Tesla. And of course, I'm giving a lot of detailed information about Tesla on my paid cast. I have a series called Tesla's Mind, which is ongoing every week. In fact, next week will be another episode of Tesla's Mind in the paid cast. If you haven't subscribed to that, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and subscribe to the paid cast. But anyway, I just wanted to give an anecdote on this show about Tesla. Tesla died in early January of 1943. So this is right smack dab in the middle of World War II. World War II is raging on the Atlantic side in Europe, of course, and it's raging. The Pacific War had already begun, and of course, and that was waging in the West. So the United States had war going on all over the, you know, Second World War. The whole world was involved in this. Tesla had an invention, and I'll be talking about his weapon inventions in detail in my future paid cast. But one of them was a method for, there were two of them basically. One was called the death ray, but the other one was a defensive weapon in which it would prevent primarily air forces from attacking a country. And he said he could set up his installations to eliminate any incoming bombers or aircraft. And in fact, I've confirmed that this was a real invention. He did have it, and I'll be talking exactly how this works. But here's the kind of dark side of this entire story. The day before Tesla died, he gave an interview with a young woman reporter and said that he would be leaving the next day with some British dignitaries, and that was the last day that she would be able to talk with him. He died the next day, and so this is part of the very strange story. Tesla was negotiating with Russia. Remember, Russia was in alliance with British and United States interests in World War II against Germany. So Tesla was attempting to sell to Russia, to England, and to the United States individually his defensive weapon technology to prevent air forces from attacking. Of course, this would be absolutely of prime interest to all of these countries, especially England. Russia not so much, because the German Luftwaffe was concentrating on England, but as soon as they got done with England, they were going to turn their Luftwaffe loose on Russia. Tesla also attempted to sell this technology to his home country of Croatia, which, of course, was under attack from Hitler's armies. So Tesla had an invention that had the capacity to shut down World War II, because World War II was, even though it was land armies, it was supported tremendously by aviation and naval forces. So at any rate, this issue of him having an interview the day before he died with this woman, and she talked about how he meticulously weighed out his food and ate his lunch. He was at the New Yorker Hotel in New York City, and he was in his 80s, so he was an elderly man. He had was failing in health, but he wasn't near death from any stretch of the imagination. So she comes back the next day because she wanted to follow up and ask Nikola Tesla, a couple more questions. She gets back to the hotel room. It's completely cleaned out as if nobody had been there. All his papers, of which there were vast amounts of paperwork in his hotel room, all of Tesla's work, all of that was gone. And then she heard the announcement that Tesla had died. But even if he had died, it would be very strange for somebody to come in and take out all of his documentation and paperwork. And he was thinking he was going to leave with a British dignitaries, which meant he believed he was closing the deal with England to sell his technology, defensive technology, to England. The story that has come out since is that George Bush Sr., who was 19 years old at the time, is the one who went in and cleaned out Tesla's goods and handed them over to basically the secret societies that were operating the world at the time, who were sponsoring World War II. We know that the Rockefellers and the New York bankers were funding Hitler. So, in fact, George Bush's dad was one of the specific people who the Trading with the Enemy Act of Congress was passed to prevent him from selling war goods to Germany. This is George Bush Sr.'s dad. All of a sudden Tesla dies mysteriously. All of his paperwork is gone. And the ability to shut down World War II goes with it. That's the important point here. So in the hands of George Bush Sr. was the technology literally to shut down and stop World War II. But they didn't release it. It never got to England. It never got to Russia. And, of course, the United States did not use it. So what happened with that technology? It certainly went underground. And I'm of the opinion that they didn't know what it meant, because Tesla was not the kind of person that gave out all of the information. And that was something that I myself learned early in my career, is you never give a government entity, especially the U.S. military, you never give them all of the details. You always hold something back. And so anyway, it's probably true that the U.S. military and their physicists did not know what Tesla was doing. Now, Tesla, there was a story where he had negotiated with England for this technology and that he wanted his money up front. He wasn't going to just give it to him and then hope they paid him. He'd already been around the block with the military-industrial complex. And, of course, the people that ran this on a worldwide basis. Remember that the Rothschild banking empire, with its surrogate staff in the United States, the Rockefellers and the Bush, the Schiffs, really, if you want to know the true history of their name, the Schiffs, which they changed their name to Bush. So as with most of those people that came in to infiltrate the United States, changed their names. But at any rate, they had the technology at that time to shut down the United States, and it is apparent to me that they killed Nikola Tesla. George Bush Sr. was in on that, and that is very close to completely historically documented information. So now you can start to see where the Bushes, when John Kennedy Senior, John JFK, was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. Who was there but George Bush Senior? this guy has been a complete wrecking ball in the United States since he was a young man. And of course, their game is war. By war, taxation, manipulation, and information control, this is the CIA. Remember, George Bush ran the CIA. He was later vice president under Ronald Reagan, where he ran the House, the White House during that era. Remember Iran-Contra and the drug trading. Remember that he was affiliated with Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton was a young man. There's a picture I saw that was taken by the same person that demonstrated the picture. It's a picture of George Bush Sr. sitting next to a young George Wallace down in Alabama, and sitting next to him was the father of the guy who took the picture, who was George Wallace's right-hand man, and young Billy Clinton, who was probably at the time in his early 30s, accompanying George Bush Sr. These guys were buddies from way back then. They have been manipulating the United States. When George Bush Sr. got done being president, handed off the wand, the presidential wand, to Billy Clinton, his good longtime buddy, George Bush Sr. went up to Canada and worked with the Royal Bank of Canada to control the water rights in the Western Hemisphere. Now, why is this important? Because in 1991, George Bush took a man named Dan Golden out of the CIA and directed him to start taking control of the world of science. Why is 1991 important? Because that's when Robert Harrington discovered Planet X. And as I show in my DVD, which was released July 23rd last year, 2015, a little over a year ago, I show that Harrington's discovery, when he was down in New Zealand, his discovery of Planet X was literally the nucleus of the comet of Hale-Bopp, which was officially discovered in 1995, a number of years later. And so that's why the tremendous disinformation campaign about Hale-Bopp, the tremendous disinformation of crazy lady talks to alien, Planet X, we're all going to die on May 15th, 2003, all of that came out of George Bush's CIA-controlled science programs. That's when Tier 2 science came along, the garbage science passed off to you, the public. That's when Tier 1 science got separated so that you never saw it again. So at any rate, sometimes people say, well, I don't want to hear about politics. If you don't understand what went on back then, how are you going to understand science and the science garbage that's being passed off on you, the public, today? You're not going to understand it. On to the main science topic, population, the mathematics of world population. On my webpage, the jmccsci.com webpage, scroll down to the center column, I have some charts and graphs, etc., of population of different populations of, like, China, India, the United States, the world. And then I have some other interesting maps, like soil depletion or arsenic content in the soil. And these are things that are really mega problems for the entire world. The world has an arsenic problem. There are places where the arsenic level is so high, people don't realize it, but they are slowly poisoning themselves to death simply by drinking tap water. Or even if it's poorly designed filters, water filters, they're drinking arsenic in very high levels. So at any rate, that's important. But what does this have to do with you? Well, what it has to do with is the world population and the survivability of the world population if a natural disaster occurs. Because imagine you live in the center of Indiana. Let's take an example. Right in the heart of what we call the breadbasket of the world, the United States, or Kansas, or Nebraska, or South Dakota, or Iowa, for example. This is some of the most depleted land in the world. In other words, if you tried to grow something there, it wouldn't grow. It's literally been farmed to death. And once the minerals are gone from the surface, you're not going to get them back. Secondly, of course, a lot of these areas have been Roundup and herbicides and pesticides have been used to the point where the insect population is no longer there. And the natural bacteria that the plants need, for example, the chain of life between bugs and worms and bacteria in the soil, that entire chain of food chain that's necessary for healthy soil for organic non-GMO crops to grow. So say there was a natural disaster. You're living in the middle of Indiana. You think, I'm going to go out and plant crops. You know, I'm going to plant my seeds and grow and try and survive. Chances are you would have a better time planting those seeds on the planet Mars along with Matt Damon than planting them in central United States. Or say if you went to get groundwater and you were going to drink it, you're going to be drinking water laced with arsenic. Arsenic is a major problem. There's a big problem in many parts of the world with boron, especially Chile, South America, or Bolivia. Those countries have a severe boron problem where they cannot grow crops. Boron is not necessarily toxic to human beings. You'd have to drink a boatload of it to actually have it be toxic, but it changes the alkalinity of the water, and so plants simply don't grow in it. So there are so many factors. I'm going to cover some of them tonight, but the tack I want to take is simply to examine the world population and understand it from many different points of view. But let's go back to the Great Flood and then what I call the Venus event, which was thousands of years later. The Great Flood was many thousands of years before Moses, or in the terms of the Maya or Incas or Aztecs, the time when Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, came through the solar system. And we know from the Maya that it devastated Earth on two occasions. It also came by Mars, ripped the Martian atmosphere and oceans off, leaving the dry hulk that we see today. Mars currently is doubling its atmosphere every 10 years. And this is known from spacecraft data. But back to planet Earth. After the major Earth-wide disasters, the population centers of the world were primarily in Tibet, northern India, and in the mountainous regions of China. That's where the vast majority of survivors lived. They lived in those areas, and that's why those areas today have, you know, extremely large populations, because they had a big head start. When Marco Polo came across and discovered the spice trail to the east, they had no idea in Europe that there were those large population centers there. When the discoverers came from the east going west and discovered the large populations of Japan and China, these were civilizations that were extremely old. When they came to South America, Magellan, there was an estimated how many 4 million people living in South America along the coastline, possibly many, many more inland. But the name Tierra del Fuego came from Magellan as he rounded the southern tip of South America. They saw all of the fires from the indigenous people. They saw them up in the mountains, and that's why it's called the Land of Fire, because they saw all of the fires burning at night up there. And, of course, they did land. They picked up, according to Magellan's record, a live giant. So it was the Land of Giants. By the way, that area of Patagonia is an area where the largest mastodons on Earth grew and the largest dinosaurs. So there's something about Patagonia in South America, that southern region of South America, where things just grow big. It's very strange, but it's probably due to mineral content or other properties, probably the mineral content there, which allows bone structure and rapid growth in the population. So very interesting facts there. And of course, it's close to Antarctica, which, by the way, is the largest land tract on Earth. If you look at the continents, Antarctica is literally the largest single tract of land on Earth, larger than Russia. But the population is technically zero, and so it has the lowest population density of any place on Earth. I'm going to start talking about some very interesting facts about population, but what I want to come back to is what would happen if we had a worldwide disaster again. What would happen to the population? So when you're looking at the population charts, understand that living next to the ocean, for example, tidal waves. Let's imagine that a Planet X comet-like object comes through the solar system, sets up tidal waves. The Mayan talk about this. The Colburn talks about it, the vast tidal waves that resulted from a large passing comet. So the coastlines and probably 95% of the world population lives near coastlines. But if you look, this is something I want to point out, when you look at the population density of China and India, a good portion of those countries, the populations live inland, and they're very self-sufficient. They're very poor countries, but they already know how to live on very little. So let's take a look at some of the population facts here. Africa, if you look at the countries with the highest population growth, Niger, Somalia, Mali, Chad, Angola, Congo, Burundi, Uganda, Gambia, Nigeria, Mozambique, Zambia. Let me just scroll down here. Malawi, Tanzania, Senegal, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Guinea, Equatorial Guinea, Congo, Benin, Liberia, Cameroon, Sierra Leone, and the list goes on. But all of these countries, Ethiopia, all of these countries have more than 5% population growth per year. In other words, they're growing, and some of the higher ones are close to 8%. Niger, for example, has almost 8% growth. In other words, they're growing at 8%. So the dark continent of Africa is unquestionably growing by leaps and bounds. The black population of the world also is growing by leaps and bounds. The fastest growing population in the world in second and first world countries is also the black population. And so for example, I saw some information, a special on England. And now the native population of England has literally become a minority. So the native populations are being, what you might call the native populations, the populations that were established in the colonial period, are being outnumbered simply by populations that were brought in for slavery, which is something that happened historically, say, in Rome and throughout other epochs during the history of the world. Now, I'm going to start concentrating on the largest populations in the world, just give you a few fun facts about these countries. China leading the world with 1.4 billion people, India close second with around 1.4 billion people, and the United States is by far and away the third most populous country in the world at 324 million people. Now, the United States 15 years ago had a population of around 270 million people, and the population was declining. So the growth rate in the United States is due to immigration, and immigration, the birth rate due to immigrants. The fertility rate is close to 2% in the United States. So that's fairly significant. India has 2.5% and China has 1.5% growth rate in population, even though they have very large migrant, large numbers of people leaving those countries. Another interesting statistic is the number of people per square kilometer. India is packed with 446 people. Bangladesh has 1,200 people per square kilometer, if you can imagine that. That's on an average basis. And those people are spread pretty much around the country. But here's the numbers that I find extremely interesting. Number 9 population in the world is Russia, with one of the lowest densities, population density in the world, with 9 people per square kilometer. And 10th on the list, with literally almost the same population as Russia, is Mexico, our southern neighbor. Now, this is something I wanted to talk about because this is really important. If you combine Mexico and the United States, we're talking about literally 500 million people. And the reason I say that is because of the 127 registered census people in Mexico, there's probably around 50 million in the United States. So where should you count them? Should you count them in the United States or should you count them in Mexico? I would count them in the United States. So instead of 324 million, the United States has around 360 to 370 million people, which puts the combination of United States and Mexico as a single entity with 500 million people. And there's something that happens in the population growth curve. Once you get to that population curve, it starts going exponential. Mexico has doubled its population every 12 years for the last 40 years. 1970, when I lived in Mexico, the population of Mexico was 40 million, and Mexico City had 10 million people. I lived in Mexico City. Within 10 years, by 1980, Mexico became the largest city in the world, past Tokyo, which was previously the largest city in the world. Mexico City became the largest city in the world with over 20 million people, and the population of Mexico also doubled. And I always thought it was because all the people were coming into the city, into Mexico City, but the entire country of Mexico was doubling in population every 12 years since that. 1970, population of around 40 million. Mexico has doubled its population every 12 years, and it's continuing to do that. So let's look at what's going on in the United States with the Mexican population, which is now literally becoming more than the black population in the United States. And these are just facts and figures, because the population in the United States by the year 2025, at the rate it's going, and remember that the illegal alien population in the United States is unregistered, 40% of that is under age 5, if you can imagine that. It is not on the register. And so if you look at that cycle, by the year 2025, the United States will have a population of 800 million people. Now, take your glasses off, put them down on the table, and think about this for a minute. We're going to be pushing, in another 10 years after that, the population of India. Imagine this. This is startling information. Currently, the United States, 82%, about 83% of its population lives in cities. And so I've got some population diagrams of the United States. Imagine those spikes that are on these maps doubling. And that's where the population will be. That's not going to be population out in the countryside. The United States, if you look overall, has a population density of around 35 people per square kilometer. Imagine more than doubling that to around 80 people per square kilometer. Now let me turn my direction to Europe. The countries in Europe are relatively small. They're very highly populated, especially the more what you'd call the first world countries, Germany, France, etc. And Germany, for example, has around 80 million people. It's the population density is around 240 people per square kilometer. 77% of the people in Germany live in cities. So in the industrialized world, it appears that more people live in the cities. In China, around 60% of the people live in cities. Brazil, which is right up there with Indonesia, as fourth and fifth in the world population is Brazil, 200 plus million people, has a population density of only 25, but 84% of the people in Brazil live in cities. That vast area of the Amazon is basically without population. So let's look at the world population in terms of population centers and also in areas where there simply are no people. There are vast areas of China that have literally no population at all. Very large areas of China. India has a population which is spread kind of all over, but the Indian population is in the northern part of the border with Pakistan. And so the population in with Bangladesh, that's where the majority of the population of India is. So if there were a natural disaster such as a Planet X type of object coming through the solar system, India would probably fare fairly well. If you look at a natural disaster such as happened in Haiti, Haiti has the vast majority of people living in cities. And around 60% of the population in Haiti lives in cities. It has a growth rate of around 3%, which is fairly high, and the population density around 400 people per square kilometer. Just kind of a little fun fact as I'm scrolling through my notes here. Monaco has a population of only 37,000 people, but a population density of 25,000 plus people per square kilometer. Absolutely off the charts compared to any other country. But, of course, there's probably the wealthiest people in the world also. So very interesting. There are certain places like Puerto Rico, extremely high density population. The density in San Juan in certain areas is off the chart, even compared to New York City. A little earlier, I was talking about depleted soil, and I want you to study this depleted soil map. But the turns out that Russia has some of the most stable, viable soil on the planet, and that's because they've taken care of their resources. Russia does not allow GMO or high industrial agriculture or Monsanto, any Monsanto products, nor does it allow Roundup. There's other countries that have gone that way also. But of course, if you listen to my Paidcast special on glyphosate, one of the conclusions is that once glyphosate is in the ground, it really destroys the land. But Russia has pristine property, let's put it that way, and Putin is protecting it. The Monsanto and the U.S., they've tried everything to try and get GMO and destroy the land of Russia. Chemtrail spraying has been forbidden in Russia. So everything they're doing to the United States is prohibited in Russia. If you remember, I announced this a number of weeks ago, that Putin is giving land away in certain areas where they are promoting organic, non-GMO farming. They want to become the world's leading producer of organic, true organic farming products, the agricultural products. And They're giving land away, and the rule is that if somebody goes there and lives there for 5 years, works the land, then the property becomes yours, including the house. So you can build a house there. And they're encouraging people to do this because Russia actually has a falling population. And if you were a world leader, you know, a typical acceptable growth rate would be like 1%. Let's say that would be typical. If you start getting up to 1.5 to 2 to 3%, that's not good. That type of growth rate, natural growth rate, is not good. But Russia has a declining population growth rate. And so Russia is trying to build up and maintain its population. And so they have to produce a reason for people to stay there. And, the Western cultures have put a brain drain and a talent drain on Russia. And they're trying to keep their people there. Remember, Russia is not that populous of a country. It's up there. It's ninth on the world list, but it's, in terms of the rest of the countries in the world, it's just a little bit above Mexico, which is a very small country. Now, I'm going to insert something here because there's probably a lot of people thinking the same thing. Where should I go? Because there's a lot of people who want to step off the merry-go-round and just get away. And I've talked to people who are very serious about this. I told them, make a plan. Stop making your house payment. Stop making any bill payments at all. Take that money and store it up, because by doing this, you're going to crash your credit, which is a good thing. That's something that you would like to do. But take the money, as much money as you can. Take your savings, sell off other unwanted things, and pool your money. And then the question is, where do you go? And I'm not going to tell you specific places, but I'm going to tell you the kind of things you look for. And if you're going to stay in the United States, there's probably 4 states where you would want to go. In the other states, you would not want to go. I could tell you for sure, one state you don't want to go to is Florida. That place has been chemtrails sprayed to death. That's a place you don't want to go, and for many other reasons. There are many states where they are very much encouraging people to move there. And there's, for financial reasons and, those type of reasons. But it's also reasonable, and they have a decent climate where you can live, raise crops. They haven't polluted the land. They have fresh water. They have abundant rain. They have hills, and it's far enough away from the ocean. So, like I say, I'm not going to tell you where to go. I'm just going to tell you what to look for. And then also look to make sure that the area isn't excessive with arsenic. But the other thing is, you can deal with the arsenic issue if you have filtration, if you have water filtration. Then arsenic is no longer an issue. But don't pick your place only on that. And also, these places, the land tends to be far less expensive, and the people tend to be more homey. In other words, you can leave your door open when you leave. The neighbors are friendly. The people down the street are friendly. When you go out into the countryside, the people are friendly. They'll help you out. They'll tell you where there might be a local source of water, a fountain or an underground spring that the people go and get their water, etc. You know, people are just very helpful. And like I say, there's probably 4 or 5 states where you can go and live a decent life and go into the future. So try and pay everything in cash. And then if you can, work locally. Get a small job, earn some income, be a member of the community, a productive member, and change your existence. But get out of the city. That's the first thing. Homeschool your kids. You'll need internet, good communications, and have a place where your kids have social encounters with other kids their same age. That's very important for kids growing up. But at any rate, part of the reason I'm giving this talk tonight on world population is because I believe that the world is in for a bruising. Something is going to happen with Fukushima. An estimate that came out of some people that I do radio shows with now and then, but the estimate is, and I will say this because I believe it myself, that due to Fukushima, a third of the world's population's food supply has been tainted, if not polluted, with radioactive waste from Fukushima. And so if you look at the Pacific Ocean, unfortunately, that's one of the main polluted areas. So where does one go? The world is a big place, and I'm not going to give people, like I say, I'm not going to tell people where to go or what to do, but that's what I would do if somebody said, and I've told this to people, and I said, by the way, I don't give advice, I don't give financial advice, but, this is one recommendation, and consider it. Simply that, for whatever it's worth. But also, when you do this, look for the population centers. It would be good to be near a small population center, maybe 20,000 people, within a 10-mile radius of a town with 20,000 people, because you do have access, if you live there for a long period of time and society maintains, you do have access to relatively modern conveniences. But it's not so close. I would not be within 200 miles of a major city. I did some research online regarding how big a garden you need depending on the number of people you have in your household. How big a garden do you need to grow all of your food? And most of the assumptions on the internet, they assume that you're going to buy some of your groceries at the grocery store. But there are very few good analyses of growing your own food, everything you need, everything including the eggs, getting fish, getting your greens, your fruits, everything like that. How much land do you really need? And by the way, this includes growing corn for the feed for the chickens, etc. This means you are self-sufficient. And these are the numbers I came up with. Per person, and you would want to estimate that you have a family of 4 to 10 people or a group or whatever, 1,000 square feet per person. Now, this is minimally what you would need. I would certainly double this and have extra and have stored up for future years. I would also make sure I was growing heirloom corn and potatoes and vegetables, etc. So that's an area of 10 feet by 100 feet per person. Now remember, this is for this includes the corn for the chickens, for animal feed, etc. But that isn't all you need. In a lot of places, you need firewood, you need a woods, and you need something, say, to trade for barter or extra crops. And there's other things that you might grow, like for pasture, for animals. So how much land do you really need? A hobby farm of 10 acres, probably 5 acres would be sufficient. 10 acres would be nice. 40 acres would be very nice, unless you're next to some, federal forest or something like that, where there's nobody around and you can cut wood or things like that. But basically, to have a renewable source of wood and also wildlife, that type of thing, it would be nice to have 10 acres, and 40 acres would be really nice. Also, you can vastly improve your production by having a greenhouse. Just a quick mention, on my webpage, I talk about the Permacube, a very high concentrated area where you can grow food and fish, etc. So that's kind of the wave of the future also. But in a more primitive setting, you might have a small pond where you grow fish that might be connected to a natural water source. A stream coming through is surface water is always good. I would avoid being next to any major rivers where you would have flooding, or it would be dangerous in the springtime for the kids. You know, flooding waters in the springtime, etc., is always a danger. But having running water, a small stream or something like that, and then, of course, an area where you get good sunlight day for the summer days where you would have your garden, so it gets a full day of sun, not blocked by a hillside or etc. So these are the kind of things that you look for. But minimally, I would say 5 acres would be nice to have 10. It would be really nice to have 40 acres available in a normal setting. And of course, if you're in Arizona, things are a little different, because what you need in any place is a source of water. Make sure you have plenty of fresh water. But let's go back to the world population. What if you took the entire world population of it? Right now, it's at around 7 billion, let's just round numbers, 7 billion people, and say you wanted to build a stadium, and each person had the size seating area of a regular, say, football or soccer stadium or basketball stadium or whatever. How big would this be to contain the world population of 7 billion people? And I was a bit generous. I gave everybody a meter by 1 meter area. So this is 7 billion people. Each person has 1 meter by 1 meter place to put their seat down and sit. The area to contain the 7 billion people of the world would be around 480 miles by 480 miles. If you took people and put them in a little apartment cube, 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet. So that's about 3 meters by 3 meters by 3 meters. And this would be a little single efficiency apartment, let's say. And you put the 7 billion people of the world in an apartment complex with 3 meters by 3 meters by 3 meters. You could put that apartment complex, it could be contained wholly in the Grand Canyon. Now, if you've been to the Grand Canyon, it's a big place. So you think, gee, the Grand Canyon, that's just a little kind of scratch mark on the earth. But I've been to the Grand Canyon, looked across, and I hope all of you have been. And if you haven't, go there, because it's worth seeing. It's a marvelous sight. But imagine filling that up with 10 foot by 10 foot by 10 foot cubes, one person in each cube, and filling that entire Grand Canyon. That's 7 billion people. But, of course, they're spread all over. There are very few countries like Canada or Russia that have under 10 people per square kilometer. In other words, Canada is four people per square kilometer. But remember that the vast majority of people in Canada live in cities. The vast majority of people in Canada are in those eastern three big cities. The statistics are that over 80% of people in Canada live in the city. So Canada, being the fifth country in the world area-wise, it's neck and neck with the United States. So, you know, fourth or fifth, whatever, however you place it. But Canada is a vast, vast area with a certain amount of political problems, but they don't have the military budget of the United States. They have vast regions, and the majority of people live in the cities. And they've west of Quebec, they've actually taken very good care of their land. And so, of course, so you have the problems like up in Saskatchewan, Alberta, with the uranium mining going on right now. But Canada is a vast area. It is number one in the world in water. Canada has more fresh water than any other country on the planet, which makes Canada, with a population of around 32 million people, a very desirable place to live. I myself would probably not move to Canada unless I could build a big domed structure and live in it, because, I grew up in the cold. I could certainly live there again. Based on the other factors. But there's a trade-off. The benefit of living in a place like Canada or Russia or other countries where you have excellent soil, good growing conditions, a vast amount of fresh water. But if there were a pole shift, let's go back to the Planet X scenario of a pole shift. If it went as far as 10 degrees, only 10 degrees, and the last pole shift was around 32 degrees from where the current North Pole is to where the old North Pole was in the just north of the state of Michigan in Ontario, and of course I talk about this in my books, but that was around 30 degrees. That was when the planet comet Venus came by before Venus became a planet. But only 10 degree shift would put, if the shift were northern, in a northerly direction, it would put the person almost up to the Arctic Circle. Probably not a good place to try and survive. So you have to take that factor into consideration when you're planning on where you want to be. Go for or imagine a 30 degree shift in the pole. And so if you were at 20 degrees north latitude and you went in a northerly direction, you would end up at 50 degrees north latitude. And by the way, if that happens, we're also going to have a mini ice age. So that's why, for example, India and China fared very well in the last pole shift, because they were very near the equator to begin with, and they were very near the equator after the pole shift. Other factors come into play when you're trying to figure out where you want to be. And, you know, this is something where you could start planning long term. Remember that Siberia, what is now Siberia, was a more temperate climate. And the mastodons, which are frozen in that vast ice field up there, millions and millions of temperate climate mastodons are frozen in the tundra in Siberia. They moved northwards, whereas the North American continent, what we consider southern Canada and the northern states of the United States, moved to a southerly direction, and they were completely covered by the old North Polar Ice Cap, which we call the Laurentian Ice Shield. So there are many things to consider, and my goodness, I am out of time for this week. Maybe I'll continue this next week, because this is a very important topic. Remember that the red letter sale is still on my webpage, the jmccsci.com webpage. Reduced prices on water filters, the filter elements, and the major filter elements, both the standard and the imperial size filter elements. Remember to sign up for the weekly webcast, the paid cast, $3.95 a month, and you get every week an extra paid cast where I take a deep dive into esoteric scientific topics, something you don't want to miss. And this week's paid cast topic is how to use my books, CDs, DVDs as a basis for understanding. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.